To introduce today's speaker, I've known Michael for half a dozen years. We've traded emails, writings, so on. Michael is someone whose mission is to try to help churches walk the talk, and he's passionate about it, as you'll hear. He's also the author of 4 books about church life. I know some of our members have read several of these, and we've used some of these as study guides. One is called Creating Congregations of Generous People. Another is Beyond the Collection Plate. A third is The Almost Church. That was a critique. And the fourth, the newest, is Living a Call, Ministers and Congregations Together. And that has some essays in it of younger ministers entering the movement with their optimistic visions for the future. One of those essays was written by the Reverend Hannah Wells, who was one of our ministerial interns about 4 years ago. Mike has also been a visiting lecturer at Harvard Divinity School, at the Vancouver School of Theology in British Columbia, and at the Cathedral College at the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C. It is both an honor and a treat to have him with us this morning, as you'll find. Now, let us begin the worship service. It is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. It is a place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song.
The reading this morning is from Episcopal Bishop Charles Venison from his book titled In Praise of Congregations. And he writes, "On Sunday mornings, people leave behind the circles they frequent and the routines they follow, and they come to church. They come glad, they come sad, and they come mad. They come eagerly, they come expectantly, they come deliberately. They come automatically, and they come reluctantly. Some come thinking that nothing really will happen, while others come hoping everything will happen. Some come bored by the familiarity of it all, while others come frightened by its unfamiliarity. Some come out of loyalty to their religious backgrounds, while others come in rebellion against their backgrounds. Some come with an easy sense of self-satisfaction, while others come with a guilty sense of dissatisfaction. They are a mixed group of saints and sinners, sheep and goats, wheat and tares, what Luther called a corpus mixtum. Still, for all these reasons, they come."
Please join me in a spirit of prayer. Let us attend to our souls, not supernatural souls, but deeply natural souls. Our soul is that part of us where the quality of our allegiances intersects with the quality of our commitment to define our actions and, over time, our character. Let us attend to those souls, but gently. We know that we mean well, perhaps especially when meaning well doesn't cost much. And we know we're seldom as good at it when it does cost us something. We mean well in our relationships. We mean well in our work. We mean well with our children, with our relatives, with our friends. How often do we pray that if we're to be judged, we want to be judged on how sincerely we meant to do something, rather than how completely we did do it? We need to try. The world needs us to succeed. In between lies the valley of guilt. Perhaps only the saints could actually do as well as they meant to do. It's left to us to try, then feel guilty because we didn't do it all that well, then to try again. In this time, between trying and trying again, let us pause and know that even our best efforts are blessed. Let us be sure to accept those blessings to feed our souls and to heal them. For our souls are blessed by our aspirations, and sometimes we need those blessings as fuel to go on. As we prepare for tomorrow, let us welcome and embrace the blessings for what we have done, what we have tried, and who we have been. Amen.
Good morning, everyone. I'd like to thank Reverend Davidson for the invitation to be here with you this morning. It's an honor and a privilege for me. I'd also like to say before I get rolling up here that I realize I'm an unfamiliar face before you this morning, but I am one of you. In the last 25 years or so, I've been a member of one UU congregation or another. And during that time, my kids have gone from the nursery through the high school youth group. I've been a Sunday school teacher, a youth group advisor. I have led pledge drives and been on committees on ministry. I have raked leaves, I've washed dishes after potluck dinners, and over the years I've set up and taken down thousands of folding chairs, so I know the routine. Also, like most of you, I am not an ordained minister, and when I find myself in the pulpit from time to time, I'm reminded of the great theologian Reinhold Niebuhr, who once said that after he'd preached five or six sermons, he felt like he'd said everything he possibly had to say. So I have great respect for clergy who can preach week after week, month after month, year after year. It's something I could never do myself. Instead, I'm an independent parish consultant, and I work with both UU and mainline Protestant congregations, districts, and denominations. And the hallmark of my work is helping congregations develop tailor-made plans for the future. And no two of those plans are ever alike. So, for example, when my phone rings, clergy and lay leaders tend to express these concerns. Now, they may not all be yours, but this is what I tend to hear. That membership has reached a plateau. The pledge drive is flattened out. There is difficulty recruiting leadership. The church seems to be drifting into passivity or aimlessly into the future. Congregational life no longer touches the heart and soul, and perhaps they've lost that ever-elusive vision. And they ask if I can come and work with them to envision a new tomorrow. And what I found out is that all congregations need to redefine themselves from time to time, or they do tend to drift into passivity. After all, we like the familiar and we like continuity. So I confront these issues head-on, and I throw out some real challenges to the congregations with which I work, and let me give you a few examples here, which might be challenges to this congregation. I would encourage you to give away 10% of the operating budget to outreach and mission beyond your own four walls. And that line item should be first in the budget and not last. You do that first, and everything else follows. I believe that instills a sense of service and outreach in everything we do. Second, I'm going to encourage this congregation to give away all the Sunday offering each Sunday, not split it. What I've found is that congregations doing this find an increase in the Sunday plate offerings, as well as an increase in the annual pledge drive. So you don't rob Peter to pay Paul. One of my most controversial recommendations, but I think in some ways the least consequential, is I'm not a fan of having sermon titles and topics and the name of the speaker published in the newsletter. I believe this creates a pick and choose congregation. I like that topic, I'll be there. I don't like that topic, I'm going to stay home. And I was shocked to learn this morning that when visiting speakers come to your congregation, many of your fellow congregants stay home. Mm-hmm. I believe small miracles occur in church every Sunday, and we need to be together in community. And I don't think those miracles depend on who the preacher is or what the sermon topic is. We just need to be together. Now, I have to admit that not everyone is keen on my recommendations. I worked with a church in Atlanta a year or so ago, and we were talking about these things. In the receiving line following the service, a woman came through, looked like she was in her mid-70s, very nicely dressed. She shook my hand, and she said to me in a very charming southern lilt, she said, "If you weren't so gracious in your manner and so articulate with your message, we'd run you right out of here." At least I knew where she stood. So this morning I'd like to talk with you about vital churches, what the writer Paul Wilkes in his book Excellent Protestant Congregations refers to as churches with souls, because he believes religion is a great adventure and not a leisure activity. He believes that congregations should be called to do what they think they cannot do. I love that language. But he also believes that congregations should be pushed to the edge of their comfort zones from time to time. And that's the issue I often address in my work, is that congregations just get too settled in. They're too comfortable. And for the restless souls, it becomes a matter of conscience as to what their role and purpose in this place and time truly are. If we had more time together, I would give each of you a length of wire about this long and ask you to bend that wire in the shape of your spiritual journey through life and to share those journeys with one another. Because people in the moderate to liberal faith don't do that very well. We're very hesitant to talk about our spiritual journeys. I have found that at times when people share their journeys in the wire exercise, they weep. And they look at each other and say, "I never, ever knew that about you before." So as you can imagine, most people's wires are all twisted and turned and convoluted. But one time a young woman's wire remained completely flat, except for a little bump in the middle. And she said, "This little bump is when I got married and my husband tried to convince me to become a member of his faith." She said, "I tried and I tried so hard, but it just wasn't who I was." Now, she said, "For these flat areas, I flirted with a number of other religions along the way, but you know what?" she said, "They didn't bend my wire." So I believe when we belong to a community of faith like this, it should change our lives in some fundamental way. But I do not believe Unitarian Universalism has claimed that power for a very long time. A while back, I read a novel by Marilynne Robinson titled Gilead, won the Pulitzer Prize a few years ago. It's written in the form of a memoir of a congregational minister to his young son. And in the memoir, the father writes of his own father, who was also a minister. And he said, "My father had nowhere to spend his courage, no way to feel it in himself, and this was a great pity." And so in churches today, I wonder if we do provide people a place where they can spend their courage, because the tendency is to follow the familiar path. But St. John of the Cross wrote that those seeking God will walk the path of others, but eventually those paths will end and there will be no path. And that is my hope and dream and prayer for this congregation, that you will find yourself in uncharted territory. And in fact, I hope you intentionally go there. Because too many of our churches have become safe havens, final destinations rather than places of embarkation. And this gives me the opportunity to throw out a couple of my favorite heresies. I do not believe this church or any other UU church that the future will be built on intellectual stimulation. I sometimes challenge Davidson and his ministerial colleagues to get out of the intellectual stimulation business. Nor will our future be built on personal autonomy and individual freedom. Vital churches proclaim, "This is the journey we are on, come with us," and they take people deeper into the faith. So I'm not here today to ask you to just think about stuff. I'm here to challenge you to change the way you lead your lives starting today. I recommend that you keep Sunday as a day apart, a sacred time, by not going to the grocery store or the mall or any other commercial or retail establishments. If possible, once you get home from church here, I'm hoping you might not drive your car for the rest of the day. I encourage the church to hold a day of silence every few months or so that you can gather together and think and ponder and meditate and perhaps pray about what kind of people we are called to become. I'm going to encourage you to consider moving toward giving away 10% of your income to charitable causes. I believe that anyone can become a philanthropist, and I believe that being a generous person or family is one of life's great privileges. Aren't we privileged to be a part of a community that can create a more just and humane world? And as often as we've talked about money, I just don't think we've convinced people that giving away money is fun. It has to be one of life's great joys. Now, for those of you who have read my stuff, you know what's coming next. If you're a humanist or non-theist, and you do not relate to the biblical concept of tithing, 11% is a number that has no religious meaning whatsoever. Sometimes humanists tell me, well, I'm humanist, and that doesn't apply. Being humanist doesn't give you a free pass, I don't think. Also, I've worked with congregations, too, that when the Sunday offering goes around, people say to me, well, I've pledged, so I don't have to put money into the offering plate. I think putting money into that plate is just an extraordinary, wonderful experience. And I'm not sure when all the children are here, if that plate is passed while they're here. If possible, I would recommend that the children see that plate go around, because it's a magical experience for them to see that. You know, a colleague of mine, a minister named Anthony Robinson, does this kind of work that I do, and he often says that he works with a lot of churches that behave as though there was nothing important at stake. And my friends, I believe there is a great deal at stake, because people come to churches today hurting in body or soul or spirit. They yearn to lead a deeper spiritual life. They find the secular life increasingly shallow, or they find the world more uncertain. And they want to be part of a community of meaning and purpose. And these questions and concerns cross many denominational and theological boundaries. So to me, church is not about autonomous individuals, but rather the hard work of forming a people. A number of contemporary theologians have asked, why are churches today often ineffective in their central task? And the answer is that churches often don't offer a compelling vision of a way of life that is worth living. And so in my congregational work, I challenge my congregations to define or to ponder that way of life that is worth living, in particular, how we define what the proverbial good life is. Actually is. Because I believe the good life is one that is not dedicated toward the accumulation of material goods, but rather lives of dedication, commitment, and when called upon, sacrifice. Lives not just of success, but of significance, and lives not of abundance, not defined only by material wealth. And this, my friends, is not work for the faint of heart. Let me pause on the word sacrifice briefly before I finish up here. I led a district gathering of UUs in the Pacific Northwest a year or so ago, and there were about 150 people or so there. And during our time together, I asked them to write down the answers of a number of questions I posed and to hand those responses in. And one of the questions I asked was, would you be willing to make a sacrifice for the greater good or for a larger cause? And when I went through those responses at the end of the day, I was astonished to find that about 95% of your fellow UUs said, yes, I would be willing to make a sacrifice for a larger cause or the greater good. And I think sometimes people yearn to be asked for more. They want to be a meaningful part of a meaningful congregation. Speaking of getting out of the business, I think our movement has been in the low expectation business for too long. I don't think we've asked enough of people. In my experience, people don't drift away because we ask them for too much. We ask them for too little. Let me finish with a brief sermon excerpt from A. Powell Davies from the 1950s. He once said from the pulpit, "Do you belong to the religion that says humankind is not divided except by ignorance and prejudice and hate? A religion that proclaims an end to all exclusions and declares a brotherhood and sisterhood unbounded. The religion that knows we shall never find the fullness and the wonder and the glory of God until we are ready to share it. As you have listened to me, have you thought perchance that this is your religion? If so, do not congratulate yourself. Stop long enough to recollect the miseries of the world in which we live, the fearful cruelties, the enmities, the hate, the bitter prejudices, and the need of such a world for such a faith. And if you can still say that this of which I have spoken is your faith, then ask yourself this question: what are you doing with it?"